And we are now very pleased to be joined by the Northfield Chief of Police, Mr. Mark Elliott. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Rich. Good morning, listeners.
Yeah, you and I are just talking. Generally, our paths will cross once or twice a week, but I feel like I haven't seen you in like a month, sir. How you been?
It's been a while, yeah. You know what? Things have been busy.
Yeah.
Which probably isn't a good thing in this business that I'm in. But yeah, things are busy.
Well, I can actually personally attest to how busy things are, because Chief Elliott, my catalytic converter 2 weeks ago today was stolen out of my car while I was doing the radio show. I pulled in at whatever time I get here, 5 a.m. And then when we were done, I actually had to get out of here real quickly, and I went and got in my car and turned it over, and it sounded like the world was exploding.
I mean, yeah.
I've had some conversations with Officer Bart Weiss, who was sort of taking, and you know, no one's going to recover my catalytic converter. That's not going to happen. But I have to say that Officer Weiss has been very thorough in the way he handles things, and it's just really it's gratifying to see the way you guys go about your business. But I'm frustrated as heck because insurance covers it, but it's $3,000.
Yeah,
to replace a catalytic converter.
Folks, and obviously it costs all of us money, because that means our insurance rates are going up.
Yeah.
And all of that across the board. So you're not the only one. So since the first of the year, we've had 11 thefts for motor vehicles, and 6 of those have been catalytic converters.
Wow.
And that's just in Northfield here. And they're spread out too, because we try to look at trends. In fact, we just we've noticed kind of an uptick in what we normally have. You know, if we look over the last year, we averaged about 2.8 thefts from a vehicle a month. That could be thefts from stuff in a vehicle or equipment attached to the vehicle,
okay,
like a catalytic converter.
Right, right, right.
And this year we're on a pace of 8 a month. So
really?
That's a significant increase. You know, prevention, obviously we want folks to do that. Try to park in a secured area if you can, you know, your garage or that type of thing. Obviously you can't do that here at work, but park in areas that are, you know, have cameras or have more foot traffic and people around, that can help a little. But, you know, it's frustrating for everyone. And, you know, we know that there's nobody that's becoming a billionaire from stealing catalytic converters.
Right.
Nobody's
right.
getting rich on
right,
this.
Right.
We are pretty confident we know what fuels this.
Yeah.
And it's drug addiction.
Yes.
And it's folks looking to steal catalytic converters, go and sell them, and get a couple dollars so they can go get high again.
Yeah.
Now, there's a couple things that the state is working on. I know we'll talk about some legislation stuff today, but Senate File 5 and House File 30 both make possession of a catalytic converter a crime.
Okay.
So we're trying to address it that way, that hopefully that discourages some.
Right.
And the other part is we've had times where we've stopped someone and they have 3-4 catalytic converters in their car.
Oh, really?
Yes. But we don't know where they came from,
right,
and it's not always in the community where they were stolen from.
Right.
You know, they could have stolen them, you know, I know one of them we had last year, Faribault had stopped a car, and a guy had several of them in there. One of them, just that same night, we had taken a report from here, and we're able to match that up. But a lot of times, we're not able to determine where they came from. So if we make the possession itself of them a crime, then that can help law enforcement officers and trying to stop some of that and having a reason to arrest and investigate further as to why that person has catalytic converters.
It just feels devious and insidious what's happening.
So, you know, the other side of that, though, there's something that we'll be rolling out here within Rice County shortly, and that is a police-assisted recovery and diversion.
Yeah.
So getting folks right into treatment that we're having contact with.
Right.
Because we know that a lot of their theft crimes are related to drug use.
Yeah.
And if we can offer free treatment for folks and get them there, that's really a positive thing. So in the next couple months, you'll hear about that. We're going to kick off the program here in March. And it's all part of a federal grant that we applied for with Rice County and received $1 million over 3 years from Bureau of Justice Assistance.
Fantastic.
So some good ways for trying to get help for some folks out out there and move in the right direction.
You and I talk quite a bit about the mental health aspect of your job and how you guys approach that thing. And it's really, I mean, I tell you this all the time. It's just really good to see the society is identifying mental health as the issue it has always been.
Right. But it's normalizing that conversation.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it reduces stigma, too.
Oh, it absolutely does.
Where it used to be someone had mental health issues, where it's like, oh, there's something wrong with them. And it's like, no, they're just like the rest of us.
Exactly.
And it's good that we can just talk about that more openly now.
Right. I struggle mightily with depression and anxiety, and I'm not afraid to tell you that. I'm not afraid to say that on the radio. It's because there's a lot of us out there that do. Yep. And it's I'm glad the conversation is coming back around like this. Yeah. Anyway, Matt Hillman was superintendent, Northfield superintendent. Matt Hillman was in here on Tuesday talking about the school resource officer program that you guys have just renewed for another year. Is that right?
We did. We do it on an annual basis. Yeah. We didn't do it at this meeting, but we try to do. Superintendent Hillman and I talk on a pretty regular basis, just because some of our work overlaps and we're just both pretty active in the community. So we end up running together and being on committees and that type of thing. But our school board presentation was just to kind of bring the school board up to speed. We try to do that annually. They've got some new members on the board this year, so we want to make sure they understand. And I don't want to rehash everything he said, but what we really covered was it's a partnership in safety, security, trust, development of the students. Because I mentioned it there that our children in our community, they're our future.
Yes, they are.
And I don't want to go all Whitney Houston. We'll talk about the list later, but
we'll get there.
They are. And so it's important to invest in them.
Right.
And it's important to provide schools that are a safe place for learning. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't have to look too far. We can go about 40 miles north to St. Paul and know that they had an act of violence happen in their school last Friday. And that is part of the reason our school resource officers are in the school.
Sure.
Uvalde, we can go around the country over the last several years and all kinds of reasons that it's good to have a trained person in the school that can immediately protect our children.
Right.
And so that is part of it. But more importantly, it's those relationships we build. And we talked about this at the school board meeting that part of our goal of having that officer there is not only to protect if something happens, but to prevent. That officer is building relationships with students throughout the school, and so they're more likely to trust and to come to that trusted adult, that officer, when they say, hey, I saw something on social media or a friend of mine struggling with this, and he made some comments that are concerning to me, so that officer then can try to prevent something from happening.
And you know that firsthand because you were earlier in your career, you were a school resource officer. Is that right?
I was. I spent 3 years at a high school as a school resource officer and prior to that, a DARE officer as well.
Okay.
And so I understand those relationships that get built. In fact, I still to this day get contacted from students that were DARE students of mine or were at the high school when I was there. And we're talking, this is 20 to 25 years ago. And they'll contact me, and sometimes it's about stuff going on in their life, and not always good.
Yeah.
But they trust me. I had one student call, and he's like, "You know what? I got my third DWI, and I'm just tired of how I'm living. And how can you help? What can I do?"
Right.
And he wasn't asking for me to necessarily help him, but he's just like, "You deal with this, and you know people that struggle, and how can I get better?" I've had other people, "Hey, I'm having issues with my kids.
Yeah.
I just really need to know what to do. I know I wasn't going down the right path, and I need some help there." I've got a couple others that, being an athlete and being involved with athletes, I've had some of those that, just contact me to say, "Hey, this is going on in my life, and I just wanted to chat about it." So it really is relationships that are developed. And then here in Northfield, we have a third of our department that are Northfield High School graduates.
I didn't realize it was full of that many. That's great.
Yeah, so we have a third, which every community doesn't necessarily have that.
Right.
And I'm not saying all of our officers should be. I mean, it's good to have a mix of folks.
Yeah.
But it is kind of nice having that. And so being in the schools also means that we can maybe develop some future officers.
Yes.
They interact with that officer. It's a positive experience, and it influences them that maybe that's a career path I want to take.
Yeah, yeah. Do you... You and I are roughly the same age, and when I was in high school in the mid 80s, the student resource officer was the school resource officer, I should say, was introduced into my school while I think I was a junior in high school, and there was a little pushback back in those days about why are you putting a cop in school. Do we still hear about that? Do we still see that at all?
Oh, we certainly do. And post George Floyd with police reform,
yeah,
it really had. I mean, that's part of the reason St. Paul doesn't have or didn't have resource officers in their school.
And think about that for a second. I mean,
yeah,
with the Harding situation,
the school board just said, nope, they're oppressing our children, which I'm not naive enough to say that couldn't happen or didn't happen or still doesn't happen. But I think it's really important that we put the right people in the schools.
Right.
When I think back in middle school, we had a school resource officer there, and he was influential in me going into policing.
Is that right?
And he, I can easily say, probably the nicest man I have ever met.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, back then, I've got to look back at the chief there, and I say, hey, he did a wonderful job of selecting the right person for that job.
Right.
Right now, we have Officer Gabriel Crombie that's in our schools, who has a background in social work and youth ministry.
Yeah.
And that is someone I want in my school.
Right.
He understands just talking and chatting with people. And his youth ministry was focused at middle school age kids. As we all know, it can be a difficult time for kids.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as they're, you know, maturing, they're kind of in that, you know, in between adult and child, and they're figuring things out and all of that. And it can be kind of awkward. So having someone that kind of understands that and has worked with people that age, I think is a bonus for us.
Is there a time... I don't know, limit. I mean, do officers rotate out of that just because it's time for somebody new or?
Yeah, each department handles that differently. It's my philosophy. It's good to rotate folks so they don't get in all of the jobs that we have here in Northfield.
Sure.
And also, our department isn't that big. I mean, we're 25 officers top to bottom right now. And so just giving opportunities to people to do something other than just work in patrol or just do investigations or just an SRO. So you mentioned Bart Weiss, and he was our SRO for about 5 years.
He was.
And he was doing a wonderful job. And the only reason I moved him is I wanted to give someone else an opportunity and to develop someone else in some different skills.
Because
Bart's out on the street, and a lot of those skills that he perfected working in the schools are carrying on to make him just a wonderful officer serving our community and interacting with folks like you.
Yeah.
So part of it is professional development. It's development of the department as a whole in developing everybody within. So a variety of reasons, but it is important to select someone who wants to be there and someone that can do a good job.
Yeah.
Obviously that's not the place you want to put someone. And I know we've had that in the law enforcement profession, where they haven't had anybody that wants to be there, and they punished someone by putting them there, or someone who viewed it as punishment.
Gosh.
Well, they're not going to do a good job.
Yeah, you don't ever want to see that. That's
exactly.
Yeah, it's an important position. You got to want to be there, right?
Exactly. And, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, well, all evidence is that it's been a fantastic program in Northfield. So
I agree.
Yeah. Anyway. State legislature is in full swing
now.
And I'm sure there are things that you're keeping an eye on. City Administrator Martig was talking yesterday about the city is supporting some legislation that will fund, if I want to make sure I get this right, help to fund, so basically get some help for police officers who are dealing with PTSD.
Yeah, so there's I know of at least one bill right now moving through on that, but I know last session there was a bill that it hasn't been reintroduced this year, and I hope it does get reintroduced, but PTSD is a concern and in the line of work, and officers see a lot of trauma, and we try to give them resources. Certainly just like we were talking about mental health in the general population, we're doing that within law enforcement and providing wellness sessions for officers and check-ins and you know, just making sure that they can deal with what they see in a positive way. But we know that PTSD is highly treatable.
Yes.
You know, the military are the experts in this. They've been dealing with this for a long time. Yes. They know that they can treat people positively with proper treatment. And so we would really like to see, and the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association is supporting this, the League of Minnesota Cities, but we'd really like to see some requirements for treatment for officers, which through the city or the employer or workers' comp would pay for it.
When we talk about requirement for treatment, that's requiring the state to pay for it. Not
the officer.
Yes,
No, the employer would be responsible for paying for treatment. In fact, the bill last year had up to 32 weeks of treatment, so they would continue to be employed. They would get treatment for PTSD before a PTSD disability claim would be processed.
Okay.
Again, because we know this is highly treatable.
Yes.
And if we can treat it and get that officer back so that they are living a healthy, productive life, so they're working for us. I mean, we've got officers with a lot of experience and having been successfully treated for PTSD, man, what a great resource to have out on the street to interact with folks that are struggling, to help other officers. So we'd really like to keep those folks employed. And unfortunately, our structure and laws right now is almost like we're throwing them away.
Yeah.
We're giving them a disability retirement and saying good luck to you. And that really doesn't seem like a good way to care for them.
No.
Or care for our community.
No,
so,
it's not what we have done. Well, Frank, I'm still of the opinion that we're not doing enough for our veterans either. But, you know, you think about PTSD in terms of generally the military, first of all. But it absolutely has to carry over to the police department, all of really our public safety people.
Yes.
You know, I go to work and, you know, I get a nasty email from somebody who doesn't like something I said or whatever. You go to work and you get people yelling and screaming and you know, offering bodily harm to you. I mean, it's a whole different thing. And I think we take that for granted with our police officers.
Yeah. So it's not only the things that come towards that officer from folks.
Yes.
And we do quite a bit of training with them for them to understand that a lot of times it's situational and, you know, this person is frustrated and not dealing with being held accountable or whatever it is.
Right.
And you're the person that's on the receiving end of that. And our officers generally do fairly well dealing with that, but it's also the trauma that they see.
Mm-hmm.
The way they see that people treat other people, you know, our assaults, the physical attacks, you know, that the threats that they see someone call in and that came at the hands of someone else, you know, the domestics they see, that violence that they see from people that love one another is really difficult and for them to see. But then just all the physical trauma too, you know, the blood and guts they see, whether it's crashes or injuries just from accidents and things like that they do see a lot. And it takes its toll over time. So it's good for them to have those resources. Like I said, we do our wellness check-ins, which is something new in the industry that has just started in the last decade. And most departments are moving that way and doing that now, but it allows them to process in positive ways this trauma that they see.
Right.
And so that they, you know, can as best they can normalize or understand that their reactions are normal and that it's not odd to have sleepless nights after things like this and productive ways to try to reduce that.
Yeah. I think most people know that I used to be a bartender at Imminent Brewing and I've got a bunch of friends that have been either in or retired now from law enforcement. And a couple of my buddies, I remember one guy, coming and telling me that day he had, in Dakota County, there had been a head on, car collision and a family of five, was in one of the cars and the father who was driving had died. And the trauma that the rest of that family was dealing with at that moment, he said it shook him right down to the soles of his feet. And, you know, you and I also have a mutual friend who, came in one day. He had been, he was a Bloomington cop and he was one of the guys that dealt with the Mall of America when that horrible situation happened where the one guy threw a kid over the balcony.
Right.
And the things you guys see, the things you guys have to deal with, you just, we take police in this society for granted so badly. And, I'm glad to see that there's at least legislation, that at least somebody is, throwing something out there that's like, hey, let's take care of the cops.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think we're trying to move in the right direction there.
Yeah.
We want to care for our caregivers,
yes,
in our community.
Exactly.
And so, we're definitely moving the right way.
Right. Legal weed. That's coming, man. I'm pretty sure it's coming. What are you watching there?
You know, really watching it, well, primarily from a public safety standpoint, yeah, on it. Obviously, the bill that we have in front of us is talking about over 21, so similar to tobacco, mm-hmm, similar to alcohol, mm-hmm, and that type of thing. And, of course, we live in a country of freedoms, and yeah, we want people to be able to live their lives as freely as possible. Mm-hmm. But when it affects other people, that's when public safety, right, you know, steps in there, right, and gets involved. So we are watching those bills, House File 100 in the House. And, you know, I'm still trying to figure out why they didn't number it House File 420. I suppose they go by that when they were introduced.
You know, I suppose.
And to get it in early.
It would have been a little too cheeky, I think.
Senate File 73. But we're really watching it from that public safety standpoint. And we've really been watching the last couple of years from law enforcement, yeah, on what other states that have legalized marijuana, what problems they've had and what they've seen. And traffic safety is a huge concern for,
right,
us.
I've heard that. Colorado, I guess, yeah, it got really bad in Colorado.
Yeah. So, I don't know that it's worse in Colorado. In fact, some of the stats I've looked at, it isn't worse in Colorado. But the Rocky Mountain high-intensity drug trafficking area, or HIDA, has been studying and collecting stats more so than I think anybody else.
Okay.
And so the information that they're putting out is, I would say, where people are saying, oh, it's really bad in Colorado.
Right.
Some of the other stats I'm seeing aren't much different. So 2013 is when they legalized recreational marijuana.
Yep. Yep.
There, and traffic deaths where the drivers tested positive for marijuana increased 138%.
Wow.
And so those involving those drivers who tested positive more than doubled from 13 to 2020,
mm-hmm,
from 55 people to 131. So that's 76 more people that are dead that tested positive for marijuana while, wow, driving a vehicle.
Wow.
So this isn't, you know, how many blown tires. It, yep, isn't. These are people that are dead.
Yeah.
That can be directly attributed to marijuana in their system while they were driving.
Right.
And obviously we have DWI numbers, but when we look nationally, DWI alcohol-related numbers are, mm-hmm, down since 2013.
Is that right?
Yes. Drug impaired is going up. So, okay, the drug impairment, the crowd that's driving with that drug impairment, mm-hmm, is going up. So they're obviously not following, mm-hmm, that message.
Yeah.
Looking in Washington, for fatal crash drivers, that doubled in the last 10 years from 12 to 22, from 9% to 18%.
Wow.
And nationally, marijuana presence in fatal crashes doubled between 07 and 16. So this was an earlier study where they were studying it as those states. There was about 2010 or 12 when the first couple states came on with those, mm-hmm, legalizations. So they were seeing it double in that time too. And I don't think that should be surprising to anybody.
No.
If it's legalized, it reduces some of the stigma. Some of those folks who wouldn't, you know, use marijuana just because it's legal and they,
yep,
are rule followers.
Yep.
Now they're not, and trying to figure out that level of impairment can be difficult.
Because there's no really good way to test for THC without taking blood samples.
Right.
Right.
There is some oral testing.
There is.
But in Alabama's only state that requires it. The others, it's all in research and testing phase. So,
okay,
that's one of those things. When I look at this, I still feel like Minnesota's rushing. I know there's a lot of states, yeah, that have legalized this, yeah, but I think we're rushing into this. I don't,
right,
think the science of how it impairs people and being able to accurately detect impairment.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that accurate detect impairment is so people understand what they can responsibly use and what period of time they need before driving or operating machinery or something like that. When we think of alcohol and having the percentage of alcohol and the serving size, you know, people who think about this can kind of gauge that and know, okay, I can have two beers or I can have you know, one drink, but after that, I'm just not going to feel comfortable driving. And we've all had those friends that have said, I only had two drinks. I don't know how it happened. Well, it's because the bartender was pouring you doubles. And whether you realized it or not, it, you thought you had two drinks, but you had the alcohol equivalent of four. So
that's an irresponsible bartender, by the way.
I'm not saying it's not, but you're telling me that people aren't going to be getting marijuana and they don't know.
Absolutely.
The content. So
how's it been going? You know, Minnesota legalized Delta 9 THC and edibles in July last year. What have you seen since then?
So we've had many medicals related to people, paranoia, not feeling well generally after ingesting and stuff like that. So we've had many in town and related to taking THC. Now, some of those, because they've had the product after or still some of the product there, is not legal. And whether they ordered it over the internet or got it from another state or got it from a supplier that is supplying in-state but selling illegal, too high content, edibles, those are all have all been factors. So some of it is related to that. But I think some of it just, too, is people not – it's relatively new, not realizing the edible portion of it obviously doesn't have an immediate effect as it does, like, smoking it or vaping or something like that. So – you know, and I think we've all heard those stories of someone that took one and they're like, well, this did nothing. And they take two more. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're super impaired.
I've never heard these stories like that. Like, I don't know what you're talking about.
But I mean, we know that that happens. And so some of it is an education piece, which I get and move forward on this. If it does pass, it'll take a while, but we are concerned about the safety impacts. The amounts that they're talking about in this bill, too, are pretty high.
Are they?
We're talking about a personal possession limit of 5 pounds.
That's, I mean, if you right now, if you found someone with 5 pounds, that's possession with intent to distribute, isn't it?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, 42 grams is a felony.
Okay.
And so, and 5 pounds is like 2,000 some grams. Yeah. I think there's, if the state does move towards legalization, I think there's some things that could be done to modify this to make it safer.
Sure.
I mean, a person being able to have 5 pounds in their home, what's the potential for, you know, children, you know, other people taking, using other stuff like that? I think it's just so much higher than what we're talking about. That would, what a lot of people would deem reasonable.
5 pounds. I mean, I can't even imagine what that equates to and like how much beer you want you to have. Like you'd have an entire refrigerator plus full of beer.
Probably right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot. All right. So moving on, but sticking with the public safety thing. It was super cold for a long time and now it's warmed up a little bit. How's the ice out there? What are we seeing? How's the safety issues?
Well, from a couple aspects. So we're getting, because of these warm days and then cooler nights, we're getting that refreeze on the road. So I want folks, especially in the morning, to be really careful as they're leaving their home and driving because unexpectedly they're going to come up to that stop sign or that crosswalk and all of a sudden they weren't expecting ice because there wasn't ice in the last mile, but boom, there it is.
Let me tell you, at 4:55 in the morning when you're driving to work, that's you have to be thinking about that with every stop sign you come to.
Yeah, so we want folks to be careful there. But also, we had an inch of rain in the metro and south metro area here on Tuesday, and we've got standing water on lakes, so that's not a good thing. We've got water above the ice, and we've got water below. So that thickness of ice really is varying a lot, and it's becoming unsafe pretty quickly. I know I saw some pictures from Lake Minnetonka, and there's an ice house that had water almost a foot up from the bottom of that ice house.
Oh, my goodness.
And I know that the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office had put out information. They already had like 10 or a dozen vehicles go through the ice.
Yeah.
Out there just yesterday and last night. Yeah. So I just want folks to be careful out there. If your ice house is out there trying to get it off the ice,
right,
doing it with your one-ton truck might not be a good idea right now. So, you know, if you got an ATV you can use or something like that, it might, or a tracked vehicle, might make more sense to try to get that off.
Is it March 1st that ice houses have to be off the ice?
For the southern two-thirds of the state, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is. Right. So we're Bryce early.
County for sure.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, we're a good 2 weeks early on that, but that rain we got just is not good in it for the southern, about half of the state.
Right. Which is a drag because
fishing
is really good right now. So
right.
Yeah. Anyway, just on a personal note, Mark, you have been a guest a couple of times on my Thursday night show, the Weekly List. In fact, you co-hosted the show with me once, and I'm really hoping to get you you back on the list at some point here in the next few months.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah,
we can go on there. We pick a theme or an artist and go from there.
Yeah, you bring a totally different perspective than anyone else I get on, including my partner Daniel G. Moyer, who has the weirdest perspective of anyone I know. I want to real quick while we're talking, I want to plug tonight's
what
edition.
Are you going to talk about tonight?
Well, tonight, this is, I'm going to get all mushy here for a sec, Mark. This will be on after all of the high school sports that we're dealing with this season. So 9:30, something like that. It was Valentine's Day on Tuesday, and my wife and I have just a god-awful history with Valentine's Day. We almost from the word go, Valentine's Day, you could almost like mark it on the calendar, well, Rich and Andy are going to have a fight that day. It's just the way it's going to go.
Too much pressure.
Well, partially, right? And 20-some years ago, I said, we got to stop. We got to give up on Valentine's Day. We have to stop this. And this year, we decided that we were going to give Valentine's Day another chance. And we didn't do it traditionally. Instead, we got on an airplane for the week before and went to California and spent the week together that way and called that Valentine's Day. But, my wife, who is, not somebody who even likes to have her name said out loud, especially on the airwaves, right? Said, you know what? I want to come on your show and I want to do a Valentine's Day show with you. So tonight is the Reclaiming Valentine's Day show. We recorded this Monday night. So,
well, that is awesome.
Yeah. It's, and it's a fun show. Annie is a private person, easily the smartest person I know, but not somebody who's real comfortable in the public eye. And Mark, she just knocked it out of the park.
Well, that's great.
It's a really fun show, and I would encourage everyone to.
And we get to see an intimate insider look.
Yes, exactly.
Into
right.
your marriage. That is
into
awesome.
the Larson household marriage. Exactly. Crazy. Northfield Chief of Police Mark Elliott, you've given us 35 minutes, and I could not be more grateful. Thank you very much for doing this. And we always appreciate you coming around. As the news director, I always appreciate you because you always give me a couple of good stories to work with for the news. But it's always good to have you here, man.
Well, thanks, Rich. It's always good to come in to talk to you or talk to Jeff and share some information to the listeners out there and let them know what's going on in the community and how they can help keep our community safe.
All right. All right.